Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring.
I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next-to-listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hey everyone, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. Several months ago, I got this delightful email from a woman named Mackenzie Green. She said, "Hi, Ryan, I wanted to thank you. I took your Stoicism 101 course, and I even got to ask you a question. Prior to getting into Stoicism, I thought it was just something for white dudes in tech." This is what she's saying. She said she listened to various interviews we had with women, where we talked about women's role in the Old West, for instance. And then we talked about parallels between Epictetus and Frederick Douglass. And she said, "I started to see the Stoicism of Jackie Robinson, Harriet Tubman, Oprah, and others." And then she said, "And I saw it in my father, a member of the Little Rock Nine. And I started to see the Stoic principles in practice besides white dudes in Silicon Valley." I was so grateful to get this email because Stoicism is not just for white dudes in tech, as you know, and as I deeply believe. But I was just so surprised and excited to get an email from the daughter of someone who was in the Little Rock Nine. The Little Rock Nine being the nine young Black men and women who integrated Little Rock Central High School in the mid to late 1950s as part of the response to the ruling of Brown v. Board of Education, one of the first major integrations of American education, breaking down the longstanding and evil reign of Jim Crow segregation. We talked, Mackenzie and I said, "Hey, would your father ever like to come on the podcast?" And she said she'd think about it, that when she was traveling this summer, she might connect and talk to him. Anyways, this all happened in May. And here we are now in August recording, and I got on the line with the one and only Ernest Green, a real American hero who in 1957 was one of the first Black students to ever attend classes in Arkansas. And more than just, he's actually, as we talk about, the oldest of the students. He's a senior. Most of them are much younger. He's also an Eagle Scout, as we talk about. And then he goes on afterwards to attend Michigan State University and then serve in the Carter administration, work at Lehman Brothers, and has a whole interesting, inspiring career, but is best known for this moment of courage and bravery in 1957, where he challenges not only segregation, but faces bayonets and guns as the governor of Arkansas sends out the National Guard to attempt to stop them. So it's a fascinating story, and it's funny. You know, I was just reading this biography of Ralph Ellison for the book series that I'm working on now, And it's really funny. There's a passage here. I thought I'd read it to you. This is on page 421, where Ellison is in a discussion with Hannah Arendt, the sort of scholar on the banality of evil, a well-known philosopher on Nazism and the horrible injustices of the 20th century. She actually talks about how she was disturbed, even mortified, that families were sending their kids to these schools, potentially sacrificing them to advance this a cause that she agreed with, but she was worried about their safety. And she's talking to Ellison about this. I thought this was really great. Strenuously objecting to Arendt, Ralph pointed out that behind the parents' actions, although some students had volunteered for the tasks, and specifically Ernest Green volunteered. So I think that's another inspiring note to his favor. He says, this was neither negligence nor pushiness, but a nobility of ideals involving self-confidence, self-consciousness, self-mastery, insight, and compassion. The parents, he said, recognized the overtones of a rite of initiation in their children's suffering, and they expected a son to face the terror and contain his fear and anger precisely because he is a Negro American. And then in the discussion, Arendt concedes privately to Ralph that you are entirely right. It is precisely this ideal of sacrifice that I didn't understand. I would say that there's not a better description of Stoicism than that series of phrases there: self-confidence, self-consciousness, self-mastery, insight, and compassion. Facing terror and containing your fear and anger precisely because of who you are. I love that so much. So I'm very excited to bring you this interview with Ernest Green, civil rights activist, American hero, I would say, and all around wonderful person, father and grandfather, as we talk about. I hope you enjoy this interview. And I think on that note, a final spot to end is a reminder that my new book, Courage is Calling, is available for pre-order now. You can sign up at dailystoic.com/pre-order. I actually talk quite a bit about the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King is a hero of the book. Ernest Green talks about in the interview here that Martin Luther King actually attended his high school graduation and they got to know each other over the years. I talk about Martin Luther King. I talk about John Lewis. I talk about Ralph Abernathy and a number of other civil rights heroes, because there is no real activism or justice without courage. And I talk about a whole number of other courageous people, men and women like Ernest Green, who stood up or sat down, who did the right thing despite an enormous amount of pressure and fear and danger to the contrary. And those are precisely the people that we need to study, that we need to emulate more in our own life, personally, professionally, politically. And anyways, I hope you check out the new book. It's out September 28th, and you can get a whole bunch of awesome pre-order bonuses if you sign up at dailystoic.com/pre-order. Pick up a copy anywhere books are sold. You send in an email for the bonuses, and you can check out the book, and I hope you like it. So walk me through, I think some people are familiar with the big day as they've seen it on television so many times or heard about it so many times, but walk me through the run-up to finding yourself at this historical moment.
Well, I think you have to walk back to the Supreme Court decision of Brown versus the Board of Education, which outlawed segregation in public schools. And as I say, sometimes it seemed like a non-event, not an event, that Little Rock School Board was attempting to comply with the Brown decision that the Supreme Court handed down.
Sure.
And I'm like any 15, 16-year-old that I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. It didn't, you know, historic moments are not something you go outside your comfort zone to be involved in. But the spring of 1957, the Little Rock School Board was attempting to comply with the Supreme Court decision. At least that's what they said. And they asked for students who lived in the school district who were interested in volunteering to sign a sheet of paper. And I complied with that and signed the sheet of paper and didn't pay any attention to it. And as the summer of 57 rolled along, I had a summer job. I was the houseman at a country club in Little Rock. And, you know, I got a hamburger and a soft drink and made whatever the minimum wage was at that time. And I was a happy camper. Well, as the summer developed, it turned out that the governor of Arkansas said he was going to call out the National Guard to keep us from going to Central High School. And so you created this constitutional conflict. Again, you know, I'm like any other teenager. It doesn't check out as the most important thing for my summer. But it also meant that I had to pay a lot more attention to this event because I was the only one in the 12th grade that's the paper and was the only one that at the end of the day, the Little Rock School Board decided to invite us to become the Little Rock Nine. My interest did get heightened though, when all of this activity around our going to Central High School developed. In fact, my shorthand said to me that if all this attention is being paid to this going to the school, this has got to be some sort of big deal. And the summer of 57, the governor, who was Orville Faubus, announced that he was going to, the night before we were to go to Central, that he was going to use the National Guard to bar us from entrance. And I thought from that point on, this must be something of importance. It was important, I guess, if I look at two events that centered me. One was the Montgomery bus boycott, in which involved Dr. King and Rosa Parks and a number of other people. And then the second event was the murder of
Emmett Till.
I'm drawing
Emmett Till.
Emmett Till.
Yeah.
That Emmett Till. Emmett Till's murder was in the spring of 57. The Montgomery bus boycott began that winter. And you spent some time, you know, looking at events around civil rights. I didn't see myself as as one of the shock troopers, but I thought that if this was going to change the way Black people were perceived, the way that they had an opportunity to interact, elimination of Jim Crow, all of these things leading up to a change that I thought was great for me. I believe that non-events were something that we shouldn't pay attention to. And then thirdly, I saw all of this as helping to improve the atmosphere around Little Rock for myself.
So the other students were all much younger than you. So you in effect volunteered as opposed to your parents sort of signing you up for it. So you must have had your parents were activists right?
My mother was a school teacher. My aunt was a teacher. My grandfather was a postal carrier. And he had tried at some point to vote in the Democratic primary, and he was pushed away with the use of a gun, a rifle. My mother was also, and my aunt, involved in a court case for equal pay between black and white teachers. And the teacher who brought the suit, the moment she brought the suit, she was fired from Little Rock School District. And she, my mother and a number of other teachers pooled money together to provide income for her during the course of that year, as she was the plaintiff. Anyway, the lawyer that handled that case for the black school teachers was Thurgood Marshall.
Wow.
So yeah, we were activists without spending a lot of time knowing that this was going to be the beginning of a revolution.
And you were also an Eagle Scout, right?
I was an Eagle Scout. I had become an Eagle Scout that spring. So before I was at Central High School, I said I always used my merit badges to figure out what I wanted to do next, and that helped me that helped me get through that year.
It must have been perplexing, right? You come from a family of people who are contributing to the community. You're an Eagle Scout. You have a summer job. You are a good student. How did it feel as a kid to have this sort of intensity of hatred and disagreement and objection to a person who is effectively doing everything right? That must have been strange to wrap your head around at such a young age.
Yeah, well, you know, that's one of the inconsistencies of segregation and Jim Crow at that period of time, that the people that I knew we had a doctor, you had a pharmacist, had a lawyer, Daisy Bates, who was publisher of the weekly newspaper. All these people were making a contribution, and yet, if you listen to the segregationists, they would say that the black community doesn't contribute anything, that they are obviously not making any impact, positive impact, and that we've got to figure a way to keep them segregated and keep them away from the majority community.
So the day comes and you're there for your first day of school. I imagine this is the scariest moment of your life.
Well, to have somebody with bayonets and rifles pointed that they're keeping me away, they're letting these other students go to class. Yeah, it's a difficult issue to get your head wrapped around. But you also knew that being a black person at that point in time, that if they were working that hard to keep you out, it had to be something going on that was worth pursuing, and that this represented, to me, an opportunity to change the atmosphere change matrix of how we were considered worthless, and that it made me feel that I should be there. I mean, yeah. It was my opportunity to say that you got the wrong person. I'm obviously important, and I want to be inside that school.
I love that. That's such an interesting way of thinking about it. Yeah, the reason they were trying to keep you out is that it was very, very valuable, and they were trying to keep it for themselves, even though it was dressed up in racism and hatred. It was really about self-interest.
Yeah, and you came to the conclusion that you were making a real contribution to the community, much more so than they were willing to admit, and that segregation and Jim Crow and all of the rationale that they threw up to keep you out didn't make sense. I should be there, and I'm going to stay there at that front gate until you let me in.
Yeah, I interviewed George Raveling a few years ago. He's one of the pioneering basketball coaches. He was there on the steps of the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Monument, when King gave the I Have a Dream speech, and actually Martin Luther King gave him the speech as he walked down the stairs. And George was telling me that his grandmother would, every time she saw him, she would say, you know, George, why did the slave owners keep their money in books? Why did they hide their money in the books on the plantation? And he said, I don't know. And she said, because she thought the slaves would never look there. And what he took from that was,
yeah, well,
go ahead. Sorry, he was saying that because they knew books were valuable, but were trying to deceive him from thinking they were valuable. And that's precisely why he has spent so much of his life reading. The things that they're trying to keep away from you are the things you deserve and should be seeking out.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Well, I appreciate that, because I was at the march as well, and had an opportunity to hear Dr. King speak. Well, and I don't know whether you're aware that he came to my graduation, my high school graduation.
I didn't know that.
He was giving a speech in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, which is maybe 20, 30 miles from Little Rock. And he decided that he wanted to witness my graduation. He came up, sat with the woman who I mentioned, Daisy Bates, and my family. And so I always say that I'm one of the few people in the world that had Dr. Martin Luther King at their high school graduation.
Wow.
But over the years, I had an opportunity to see him. And I, as I said, I was at the march for jobs and freedom, that Dr. King was there. A. Philip Randolph was there. Marlon Brando was there. And it was an event to be.
I bet. So when you walk into that school for the first time, once you sort of get past the barriers and once you're inside, what was it like to be showing up to your senior year of high school, which is difficult and strange and weird, even under normal circumstances? How did you navigate that year and get your education while so many people were, you know, probably rooting for and trying to make you fail?
To have you fail. Well, I think that because they worked hard at trying to make me fail, made me also stronger in terms of trying to succeed. I paid a lot of attention to the fact that I needed to study. In fact, I had a couple of tutors that were working with me. I had a course in physics that was really very difficult for me. But the reason I got through it is I had my tutor was a physics professor from the University of Arkansas Medical School. He was white. And every Saturday for the entire school year, he and I had tutoring sessions that helped me get through that. So there were people who were trying to see that I could succeed. But most of the students were really afraid being led by their families or their community that somehow they should fail. They shouldn't help us.
Sure.
They shouldn't reach out. And I think that it's a sad state when I look back at what could have happened that didn't happen. But I was committed that I was going to go through that year. I was going to succeed, and that it was going to be a year in which I would pass my courses and hopefully get on to college.
It must have been strange. As you said, some people were rooting for you, some people were rooting against you. At first, the governor sends the National Guard to keep you out, and then Eisenhower sends in the airborne to let you in. It must have been strange that you have, you're seeing the absolute worst and the best of people at the same time.
Well, it was. And the fact that President Eisenhower sent in the 101st Airborne, which are, you know, elite troops to help us get into school, was another indication that this was a big deal. I needed to make certain that I succeed at it and that there were people around the country who cared, not just those in Little Rock, Arkansas, who wanted to see me fail.
Is it hard for you to, how do you go through the world knowing that some of the people are really good and some of the people are really bad, or that some people have, you know, Martin Luther King talked about how we all have a north and a south in our soul, and that there's a battle. Which side are you going to be on? How do you navigate seeing up close the sort of the two paths that individuals could take? That seems like it would be hard to unsee once you've been screamed at by horrible racists, yeah. Once people have thrown rocks at you, once people have threatened your family. How do you unsee that?
Well, you knew growing up in Little Rock that this was an attitude that a number of people had, and that I was taught by my family and by my friends and my community that I had value. I was worth something. I was important to me, and that, as you mentioned, the coach who said that they hid their money in books because they didn't feel that, one, black people could read, two, that they were going to look in a book. And I think that at each point, I had an opportunity, along with my friends, to disprove that they had the wrong view about who I was and what I could do. And that way, I could always read, and they wouldn't know that I had an idea where the money was.
So I think particularly growing up, I felt this way. This feels like it was all a very long time ago. But I was just reading to my son, there's a children's book, my son's four, and Ruby Bridges wrote a children's book. I'm reading the back of it, and she's only 66 years old. And you're 79, 80. It wasn't that long ago that this happened.
This was recent. In fact, we were a year before Ruby, when she went to school in New Orleans, that Little Rock was the 57, I think. She was 58, 59 when she went to school in New Orleans. But no, this is less than 100 years, and we're still fighting ideas that culminate in racist views about what people can and can't do. And that's why I think it's important for you to read to your son that we're ready to take on these challenges. We're ready to disprove backwards thinking that people have about other people, and that we're ready to show the world and this is a changed atmosphere, that this is a place that we're able to show that we can grow. We as a country have to grow. We're going a world in which people, as Dr. King said, hopefully judged by the content of their character, not who they are. So race, justice, an opportunity to show that we all can make a contribution is where we are at this moment.
Thinking about all this, I reached out to my family because my grandmother and her side of the family is all from Bearville, Arkansas. And so I asked, I said, you know, did my grandmother, was the high school she went to segregated? And they said, I guess the senior year of her high school, the Bearville High School was destroyed by a tornado. And so she went to Little Rock High School. They sent her to Little Rock High School. I think this is 45, 46, the last year of her high school. She went to the same high school that you did. And it was interesting to me to think, one, again, this is not that long ago. I spent a lot of time with this woman when I was growing up, that my own grandmother went to high school 10 years before you did, and it was segregated. But the thing that struck me about it was never once talked about. Like, you know, we talk about privilege or we talk about advantages. It never once came up that my grandmother got to go to a high school that kept out a significant percentage of the population who still had to pay taxes, who still had an equal right to go there. It's interesting to me. We talk about sort of how advantages get passed down. Like, it's never been thought about in my family that we, you know, I think people go, oh, we're not racist, but we still don't think about how that racist system benefited us at the expense of another group.
And I will add that my dad went to Europe and fought in World War I.
Wow.
Now he went to France to help.
Right.
French. And when he came back, Little Rock, he couldn't vote. It's a series of positions that when you stand on your head, it doesn't make sense. They can't justify it. They can't logically explain it. It doesn't translate. And that's why I think as soon as we can get as many of these old vestiges of Jim Crow and segregation, whether they are statues or behavior or availability of opportunity, all of it doesn't. We have an opportunity, our generation, your generation, your children, to correct that and make certain that we don't have to live in the past like we've done in the before.
Yeah, and you mentioned Emmett Till earlier. I was reading an article. Wright Thompson wrote an article in The Atlantic about Emmett Till in the barn where he was killed. And the most stunning part of that piece that really brings home how recent some of this was is that the woman that Emmett Till supposedly whistled at, although it sounds like she actually made it up, but the woman at the center of all of that is still alive.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And if you ask her what happened, she'll probably tell you she doesn't remember now. So that we are a nation that I think our strength is our diversity. And yet we fight hard not to recognize that. So that seems to me what we need to do, especially with generation of your kids, is make sure that all these blind alleys that we've been going up and down, that we get away from it and get on with recognizing who we are, why we can't be a better country than we are, and what our strengths are. I mean, it is mind-boggling that we're still fighting the Civil War, and that we can't give it up for a better future that's right in front of us.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because, you know, the irony of, and maybe sometimes it's easier to see it in when you look at another country, right? The irony of Nazi Germany is that the Second World War is ultimately won in large part through the work of Jewish scientists who are driven out of Germany by the Nazis, who come to America and Britain and do all sorts of important work for the Allied cause. And I think that's one part of segregation and racism and Jim Crow that we don't think about. It's not just that it was morally wrong. It was also economically stupid in a profound way, because I think about
the illustrious career that you've gone on to have, and the work that that many of the other members of the Little Rock Nine have gone on to do. Just being ordinary parents, raising good families, having good jobs, and to think that systematically the laws of this country prevented that from happening. If you had been born 1 year earlier or 1 year later, actually, you might not have been able to have the career that you've had or make the contributions that you've made, because we would have been shooting ourselves in the foot by holding you and people like you down. That's diversity is a strength. And yet, as you said, we seem to fight it at every step of the way.
There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. I talk about that in Growth Hacker Marketing. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stoic. That's netsuite.com/stoic.
Yeah, well, I think that in a world that seems to becoming more diverse, that if we're going to recognize our strengths as a country, we've got to recognize our assets. And it seems to me that the fact that we are not a multicultural country with people from all over the world, need to get on with proving why that's important and not see it as a hindrance.
So you experienced this, you saw sort of raw, unadulterated, violent racism up front, right? You saw the crowd screaming at you, you saw like literal troops having to hold it back. That doesn't just disappear, right? It seems very distant now, but that didn't just disappear. Where does that energy go, you think? All these people
probably.
Go ahead.
Where does the energy go? Well, that's a great question. It ought to go towards an improvement of opportunity for everybody in this country. And I think the sooner we figure that out, you know, hopefully leadership is going to spend some time trying to work on that. I think the present administration, obviously, a very important accomplishment to have a vice president of the country that is not a white male.
Sure.
In fact, it probably does greater opportunity for young women to see Vice President Harris than it does to see her as a person of color. I think that, you know, you're interviewing, you're recognizing that we are a different place. That when you talk to your son and ask him, what does he see, you know, the opportunities in America, he would probably tell you he sees Martians, which wouldn't be bad because we're spending all this time trying to get to Mars. And if anybody's up there, we're going to be shocked out of our pants. But we are at a point, we have an opportunity to look at the future as something different than our history. And I feel great about that. I see it in my family. I see it with my children, who are all adults and grown up and families that they have. Can America be different for the future than what we've seen it become in the past? And I'm an optimist. I believe that that's possible. And that's why I wanted to go to that school. And that's why I believe, you know, change is good.
Well, and that was sort of my question. I think maybe we've told ourselves a story that as soon as the schools were desegregated, or as soon as, you know, the Voting Rights Act was passed, that this all went away. And I guess what I'm saying is, you saw these people up close. You met their children, or maybe you went to class with them. They didn't magically get transformed just because Ernest Green sat next to them in history class or physics class. So how have you seen that evolution in people? Like, I guess what I'm saying is, it feels like we're having this reckoning now in the United States, because we realize that just because we made a few changes doesn't mean that everyone's soul was transformed, that we suddenly grew out of this many century long tradition of thinking about things the wrong way.
But you're answering the question because it's more than just reckoning and sitting next to me in a physics class. It's a long history. But is that it can change. There are enough people who are willing to spend time trying to make it permanent, not just window dressing.
Sure.
And if anybody thinks that simply because we did one act, we made one change here, or that
we had a black president or a black vice president.
We had a black president. All of that. It's not that it doesn't mean anything. It's just that we have been so long at trying to prove that people don't have qualities of change that we don't know when change comes. And I'm a witness that change is possible, but it is awfully difficult. It is awfully difficult. And that what we got to do is get people committed to stay with it and not give up, because we got some knuckleheads who want to resist change. I mean, I don't know where they're going to go. You know, they go to Iceland or someplace. They go to Mars, I guess. But they've got to be willing to accept the fact that we're all human beings and we've got something to contribute to the plus side of this country.
Well, I love that you said that you're an optimist, because I think people, it's not that they use that as an excuse, but it's not enough to be, you weren't just, hey, I think the future is going to be better, or I think things will work out. Your optimism was also connected with the actions that you took, right? So I think people sometimes think progress just happens. Of course it does, but progress happens because individuals and groups come together and make progress together.
And they continue to demand change. I think it's, as I said, my dad fought in World War I, and yet he was working on this abstract idea of equality. And when he came home, there were a whole ton of people who were resisting. He considered himself equal to me. Who does he think he is?
Right.
And I'm here to say that you and I and your kids and mine and my family and other members of the nine, a big world out there, but we're not going to give in to the knuckleheads that said change can occur and that I've got to live in the past. I'm going to want more. I'm willing to fight for more. And I think we have an opportunity to make the change stick.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up because it is fascinating. You talked about how we stand on our head. We can't make it work. I just looked up Orville Fabus, the governor of Arkansas, who worked so hard to prevent you from going to school. He was in the U.S. Army from 1942 to 46. He was a major in the infantry, participated in D-Day and the Battle of the Bulge. So he goes overseas to fight fascism, to fight for freedom and democracy, and then comes home and is an active participant in the suppression of those very ideas at home. It's so baffling I don't know how you make sense of it.
Well, I agree with you. I don't know how he makes sense with it either. Part of it was that we thought that Little Rock and Arkansas were a bit more progressive than some other communities in the South. That's why I thought that my first day at school, I would have an opportunity to meet some students who were interested in what I thought of the world, and I had an opportunity to figure out what they thought of the world. Mostly what I met the first week were students who were afraid to have any contact with me, that they were going to be ostracized, they were going to be told by their friends and neighbors that they couldn't have a relationship with me because I was going to turn them around. I don't know what the outcome was supposed to be, but here we are in a new century, ideas that your grandmother who went to Central High, same that I did, didn't become the flaming communists of Arkansas, right?
Right.
She was a person that you still admired. And what I think is that your grandmother and other people who went to Central when I was there, we need to hear from them, that the place didn't fall apart, Little Rock Central has had a number of students who have succeeded, done well. It was considered one of the jewels of the Mid-South in terms of the building, and that I wanted to go there because I knew that it was a ticket to a better life. And that's what education has been centuries. So that let's get on with it.
I think it's worth pointing out because, again, we can tell ourselves a story about these things retroactively that sort of absolves us of responsibility. I'm talking about everyone but you in this case. But
You know, it seems like in retrospect, obviously the governor of Arkansas was wrong, obvious that segregation was wrong, and that this was a sort of a really small minority that had hijacked things. But I just looked him up. According to Gallup's most admired man and woman poll of 1958, Orville Faber was one of the 10 most admired Americans at that time. And so I think it's really important that we look at history and remind ourselves that oftentimes the right thing, the proper thing, what in the future will seem like a clear-cut case of right and wrong, you know, we can, as society, can get completely incorrect, and that just how many people were on the wrong side of this issue as it was happening, probably including my own family. Again, it's the fact that we don't talk about it probably makes me think that we were on the wrong side of it. But I think it's important, you know, as issues happen today, that you don't just default to what all your friends and neighbors are thinking, because as we see with Jim Crow and segregation, these things that were unfortunately very popular at the time, we can be way off base.
Well, and I think recognizing that you can be on the right side of history, but it's probably takes a lot of effort, and that the likelihood is that your neighbors are not going to applaud you.
Yes.
I think we've relegated Dr. King to godlike status. Now, there were many times when his efforts were being regarded as wrongheaded and going in the wrong direction.
I imagine he wasn't given a standing ovation at your high school graduation.
Well, they didn't know who he was, and luckily, I think that the Little Rock Police Force didn't have any idea who Martin Luther King was, so that they couldn't point him out. But to his credit, he wanted to see my graduation, and I'm honored that he was there taking part of my graduation.
Yeah, he probably risked his life to be there in some sense or another.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, and in the end, he did give his life, right? It's not like he was so popular that we made him a saint, you know, in his own time. I mean, he was assassinated.
That's part of the history, and it's important to remember that. And that people who go against the grain are not necessarily the ones that we cheer on.
Right.
But let's recognize the fact that they make an enormous contribution to make this country what it is today.
So how did you come to talk about all this with your own children? I imagine you wanted them to have a normal life, but you probably also worried about their safety. And how did you talk to them about not just racism and its history in America, but how did you talk to them about, you know, activism and being of service and values? How did you talk to them in your own family?
Well, it ranged from my attempting not to bury them in the history, in my history, having them to discover it both on their own and with some help from me. My Mackenzie probably will tell you that she discovered it on her own, but one day in a history class, the teacher brought out a picture of the nine, and she looked and saw that the Terrence Roberts, who was with me, was one of the nines, and she had a perplexed look on her face. And I think that those of us who have been fortunate enough to be part of history, show up in a history book. You want your kids to appreciate what you've done, and that's where we really were. All of them, I've spoken at their classes. I said, Adam is my son, who is a history professor. I've been at every level of scholarship that he's been, so that I've tried to make myself available to be the outside lecturer, and hopefully not to bury them in my history, but to recognize that we've tried to make a contribution to the country.
And you went on, you served in the Carter administration, right?
I was assistant secretary in the Carter administration for job training, employment and training. I spent 4 years there. And then went from there to spend time on a Wall Street firm, Lehman Brothers. And now my wife is trying to get me to retire. I'm semi-retired. Every now and then I do a lecture like this. But I'm proud of my kids, the work that they're doing, and we continue to push on. I got a birthday coming up in September.
80?
That'll be the big 80.
Wow.
So
could you have imagined, as a senior at that first day of school at Central High School, that this would be the trajectory of your life, that you'd serve in a presidential administration, that a Democratic governor from the South, no less? Could you have imagined that?
No, the opportunity to serve for President Carter was great. I've known a number of presidents. Obviously, Bill Clinton is someone that I have a personal relationship with. President Obama, I went to his inauguration. It's a moment that I cherish, but I always thought that if you gave me a shot, that this is the way it would turn out.
I love that. And that, I think, again, to go to this self-interested argument, I think, and I read this once about Anne Frank. You read Anne Frank's diary and you see this precocious, beautiful young girl who's struck down in her prime, that she's really a stand-in for a generation of other talented young people that we would have never heard of. And I think when I think about your story, I think Americans should see both a triumph, but it's also a reminder, you're a symbol of all the other talented, ambitious, confident young men and women who could have served in so many different capacities that were wrongly deprived of that opportunity, and people who remain deprived of opportunities for various reasons.
Yeah, well, I hope that people see the upside of it, that it's the opportunity that we've closed out to a lot of folks. I'm sure my dad couldn't imagine, things that have happened. But I believe that, the future could be even brighter than what we've experienced. And there's no reason why we ought to cut off the lights and turn the lock on the door and not look for the future, for how we're going to get more talent and get more plus out of it.
Do you have grandchildren?
Yes. I have a granddaughter.
That must help contribute to your optimism about the future.
It does. It makes me believe that my optimism is not misplaced.
You can get that. It's fine. As we wrap up, I'm just curious.
Miss Secretary, I got to call you back. All right. Thank you. That was a person I'm very proud of, who like me, participated in government. Rodney Slater, who's Secretary of Transportation, and grew up working for Bill Clinton.
Wow.
He's now a big-time lawyer in town. But again, a guy who came from humble roots and has been able to take advantage of education and make it work for him.
I love that. Well, as we wrap up, as America in the last year and a half has sort of begun to wrestle more publicly with some of these racial issues, something we should have done a long time ago, of course, how are you thinking about, and what advice do you have to the next generation of Americans, period, Black or white, about how we keep the flame going, how we keep moving forward, where we can and need to make progress? What advice do you have?
Well, I think that my story, other stories, prove the point that we don't look under all the right places to find talent. And my hope is that we've become a lot more inquisitive about where we search and seek out people to make a contribution to this country. And as I said when we started this discussion, I'm an optimist about the future, but we got to work at it, and we got to believe that we can improve considerably where we're looking for talent and contribution and people who can make a difference. So I want to continue to look for that difference. And I believe we can make it work.
How do you think we can do a better job of that? Is it education? Is it how can people do a better job looking for talent that as you said, is not being given an equal shot?
Well, I think you've got to be willing to look at lots of different corners and underneath cans, and not just the usual. Let's not look at everybody who graduated from the Ivy schools. Let's see if we can't find some other places that people congregate and have, you know, maybe homeless shelters. We aren't looking at for talent in all the right places, as the song says. And my hope is that the last 2 or 3 years prove that we've got to be more creative about where we look and how we support them.
Yeah, not just looking for them, but also thinking about the ways that our systems and our institutions are making it harder for people than it needs to be, and thus preventing them from thriving and succeeding.
I would agree with you wholeheartedly.
Well, Ernest, this was truly an honor for me. I'm so glad that McKinsey connected us, and your story is very inspiring, and I'm honored to be able to tell people about it, and I'm glad to see you're doing well, that you've ridden out this this insane pandemic and you're still with us. And I hope you're with us for a lot longer.
Well, thank you. And I look forward to getting this book written, getting my story told. My family, my wife, my children, my sister, and extended family have been the rock of my support. And I believe we can, one, we can do better. Two, we've got to do better. And three, that better is out there waiting for us to find them and touch them and bring them in.
I love that. Well, writing books is one thing I do know a little bit about. So if I can help in any way, you just have Mackenzie reach out, and I'm happy to do whatever I can.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed our time together, and let me know what kind of response we get.
I will indeed. Thank you so much. This was great. I'll let you go, and I hope you have a wonderful Monday.
All right. Thank you, and same to you.
Bye, sir.
All right. Goodbye.
Thanks so much for listening. If you could leave a review for the podcast, we'd really appreciate it. The reviews make a difference. And of course, every nice review from a nice person helps balance out the crazy people who get triggered and angry anytime we say something they disagree with. So if you could rate this podcast and leave a review on iTunes, that would mean so much to us and it would really help the show. We appreciate it. And I'll see you next episode.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery V. Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. Us.